Hello, this is the Fisher Body Historical Team. We're interviewing today Gary Bernath. It's Tuesday, March 7th, 2006, and we are at the UAW Local 602 Frank Dreyer Greenhouse for this interview. We will go around the room and identify everyone that will be in the interview.
Gary, Judy.
Earl Nicholson.
Cheryl McQuaid.
Marilyn Coulter.
And I'm Doug Rademacher. Gary, would you please say your name and spell it for the record.
Yeah, Gary, with two R's, G-A-R-R-Y, Bernath, B-E-R-N-A-T-H.
What is your address?
7677 St. Clair Road, Eltsey, Michigan, 48831.
And tell me, do you... Tell us a little bit about, are you married?
Yes, wife, Sydney, and two children.
Two children.
Two daughters, Ashley and Rachel.
Okay. And can you tell me, what is your education background?
Well, checkered, I would say. I've had a lot of college, never completed college. Took a year's leave of absence when I was, educational leave of absence when I was at Fisher Body in 1978, went to college for a year, in and out, a lot of labor education classes due to my involvement in the union, and then I did complete a two-year program with MSU, labor concept program. Was the first graduating class out of that when they began that program.
Okay, thank you. And do you have any military service?
Yeah, I did 2 years in the United States Marine Corps.
Can you tell me, where were you born and raised?
St. John's, Michigan was a hospital I was born in, and lived my whole life in a small farming community, Eltsey, Michigan, about, I'd say, 30 miles north of Lansing.
Well, you kind of went into my next question. What did your parents do?
My father did a variety of jobs, everything from... shoe salesman at Montgomery Ward's, a now defunct department store. He worked at Consumers Power in the late 60s, back before you had to have a college education to be an insurance salesman. He hired in to be an insurance salesman in Eltsey with State Farm and worked at that job till he was 72 and retired. My mother did a variety. She worked in a small factory in Owosso, Michigan, and then hired into the school system and was a head cook in the E.E. Knight Elementary School for, I think she did that for probably about 25, 30 years. Okay. Member of the Operating Engineering Union.
Well, congratulations on that. Would you share with us what you did before you hired in to Fisher Body?
Actually, I'd worked a variety of jobs when I was going to school. Worked in a funeral home, Carter Funeral Home in Eltsey, Michigan. Then from there, I went to a company called Eugene Welding. They actually made and welded the racks, the storage racks that you would see in an automotive factory. They hired in as a janitor, but back in them days, that wasn't quite what I did. If they needed me on the line in the paint line or loading the racks into the paint assembly line, I'd do that, which I didn't mind as a high school kid. While I knew it was against the law, they also was kind enough to pay me that rate, so that was big bucks for a high school kid's versus the janitor's rate, and did that, and actually that began my interest in the union. We tried to get the Teamsters in there, was a part of that, to the point of actually, as a kid, foolishly joining arms and laying down in front of semis that wanted to come into the place while we did, I guess, what would be phrased a wildcat strike, because we didn't have a union yet, didn't have recognition, but I think it was, like I say, it was an experience that stuck with me my whole life.
Okay. We're going to go into the Fisher Body a little bit. Would you tell us, why did you come to Fisher Body?
Well, it was kind of odd. After I knew factory work at my young age, that being 18, Haven't had a belly full of it from the age of 16. Eugene Welding. It wasn't really something I aspired to. Wanted to go on to college and get a college education. Come from a large family. The well was dry, as my father put it. Suggested I join the Marine Corps, which I did, and for the sole purpose of the GI Bill. Back then, you could get a full ride at schools. They'd pay you for doing 2 years, and they'd pay you a monthly stipend for going to school. Back then, it was, I think, $410. And I would receive that every month going to college, so that sounded like a good program. Got discharged in July of 76. My Uncle Joe worked over here at Fisher Body, and he came over after I got discharged and said, hey, they're hiring at Fisher Body. Again, going joining a factory life was not appealing to me. He said, well, I'll bring you an app. And even back then, I thought, well, who would hire somebody that didn't even bother coming in and putting in their own application? My uncle, much to my surprise, I said, yeah, go ahead and do that. And my uncle, much to my surprise, brought me that app the next day and said, hey, Gary, fill it out. I'm living down the basement of my father's, having a good time just being out of the military, getting signed up for college. Thinking, again, that working in a factory was the farthest thing from my mind, and again, thinking who the hell would hire me to begin with if I don't even go in line and put in my app. Fill out the app, make a long story short, 2 days later, I get a call to come to Fisher Body. Several things played into that. My uncle knew Jeff, and I forget Jeff's name, but he was one that did all the hiring back then. Fisher Body, or General Motors, I should say. It was always Fisher Body to me, probably always will be. But back then, Fisher Body had their own personnel people doing the hiring, not like they do nowadays. And my uncle knew Jeff and handed the app. That played a big part into me getting called in, I believe. And also back in the 70s, after the war, the Vietnam War, they had a big push for hiring the vets, which probably jumped me to the top of the hire list too. So kind of a strange story. I never even showed my face, but got a job, and here I am today.
Well, you talked a little bit about working in what sounded like some factory life there a little bit early on. Mm-hmm. What was your hire in date?
At Fisher Body, it was September 3rd, 1976. I'll be hitting my 30 here this year.
So I'd like you to share with us, did you have any idea what went on inside Fisher Body from your uncle? Or?
No, I did not have a clue. Fact of it is, I feel fortunate. Don't even know if I would have stayed in there had the circumstances been different. But I hired in. There was a first supervisor was a guy named Jim Bean, and he, right off the bat, he was one of your old crew cut, you know, white shirt, rolled up sleeves with a cigarette pack in, the old, you know, your vision of a GM supervisor, if you will. He basically told me, hey kid, you're lucky, I got a good job for you. My name's Jim Bean, if you ever forget it, just remember the whiskey, and pointed me to a job installing vinyl tops. On 88s, 98s, and we also built, Buick Toronado, I believe it was. And that was the job, and I stayed on that job until they did away with vinyl tops. So the point being is had I not landed on such a good job, I don't believe I would have stayed there for the long haul.
As you say that, Gary, did you have a plan? Were you just coming in for a reason?
I had no clue. I was surprised they even got the job. Had a brother that worked over at the Olds. And, I remember as a kid, he was 2 years ahead of me. And I remember as a junior in high school, he hired into Oldsmobile right out of high school. And I remember looking at his paycheck, you know, then thinking, wow, you got it made. You know, no college education. Look at the kind of money you're making. And I really, you know, kind of thought he died and went to heaven, but again, never having a desire to I used to tell the members when I was a representative there, I said, you know, I'm not here out of a lifelong ambition to build Pontiac Grand Ams. Of course, back then it would have been to build Oldsmobiles. It wasn't something that You know, I don't believe anybody really was. I can't imagine anybody in high school saying, boy, what I want to do for a living is get in there and build, you know, Oldsmobiles or Pontiac Grand Ams. It was just the nature of the beast. It was a good job. Knew it was, you know, there was always the phrase back when in the 70s, that, boy, if you get a union job, you got it made. I heard that, you know, time and time again as a kid, you know, you got a good job if you got a union job. So, like I say, I rolled into it, landed on a great job, and still there today. Still holds seniority over there.
You mentioned you did vinyl tops. What department was that in?
It would have been in the trim shop.
And what shift did you hire on to?
Hired on to first shift. Was actually on first shift probably less than 100 days, and then, of course, got bumped. Back when I hired in the 70s, you could figure it took at least back then to have the worst job in the department, you were looking at 8 years to be on days. And once I got on nights, you know, my wife was on nights, and, you know, I just got comfortable on nights. I actually never went to days until I got elected to shop committee. And then I got my taste of days, other than that first 100 days when I hired in.
Now, you just said your wife was on second shift. Were you married when you hired in, or...
No, I knew her. We met up in our community. She was from Ovid, and I knew her, she hired in, I believe it was in 70. Yeah, she hired in 78, and, you know, one thing led to another. 26 years, we're still married.
Congratulations. Would you tell us a little bit about any other departments that you worked in while you were in the
yeah, I'd that funny you bring that up, because that brings me to the idea of actually thinking about quitting the place. They had a level in, it's called leveling off, is a term in the agreement, that if you didn't have seniority to hold a department, you could choose to go out or you could level off. And I foolishly, because I regretted doing it, but I did level off. That then took me to the paint shop. There I seen probably the most horrendous job I ever did in that place. It was spraying the underbodies. You literally, they put a hood on you. Oxygen goes to the back of the hood. You'd put coveralls on. You would tape your gloves to your coveralls. You would tape off your ankles to your boots, and you would go in this booth and spray the underbody of the Oldsmobiles as they were going down the line. It was god-awful work conditions. In fact, you couldn't even, it was so bad, you couldn't even talk to your coworker across the line. There was only two of us in the booth, me on one side, him on the other, and you couldn't even have conversation because of the conditions. Another example of how bad it was, the supervisor would come in, open the door briefly, and write line time on a chalkboard so you knew how long you were going. I mean, it was just, it was absolutely the worst work conditions I've ever had. I knew I had to do something. I went and see my doctor and, you know, told him I was getting excruciating headaches. And I will admit, I fudged that a little bit. I mean, it was so boring, monotonous, rotten, stinking work that I had it in my mind I was going to get out of there by hook or by crook. Went to my doctor, told him I was getting these excruciating headaches from being in the fumes, and I had to get out. And he wrote me a restriction. I took it on into work. They said, well, geez, we got these jobs over what they called the wet deck at the time. An equally bad job, but at least I could have conversation with fellow coworkers, and I just hung in there on that. I used to run what was called the side wheel. I run the side wheel until I could finally get back to putting on vinyl tops.
Now, what is exactly a side wheel?
As the cars went through the there was a paint prep area, the sealer room, where they came in. Of course, the first thing was that god-awful booth I talked about where they were doing the underspray. Then they'd come out into a sealer room where they would, and back then you had a whole lot of women. The fact of it is, before I got moved to the wet deck, I was being used as an absentee replacement, And there, a lot of the women were in the sealer room back then, for whatever reason. And they would seal all the cracks and the welds and everything else. And then from the sealer room, it moved into the wet deck. Or I should say, then it moved into the primer booth where it got primed. And then when it come out of the primer booth, you had to wet sand the entire car. The job I had was the worst, because obviously if you stood up and you could put the big wheel that they used as a sander on top of the car, that was a lot less work, obviously. But to stand there and hold the wheel and do the side was more work and less desirable. So that in essence is what a side wheel was.
Well, since we're in the paint department, can you share what the environment was? Was there proper breathing? Was there, I know they've switched over the years to different types of ways to draw those fumes and stuff.
And I'm referring to back in the 70s, because I've seen it on both sides, but back when I was working in it, it wasn't highly automated like paint shops are today. I mean, I'm told, and I've seen, due to my experiences, I've seen paint shops that, you know, you could roll a bowling ball down it and not hit anybody. They've highly automated the paint shops. Back then, they were using people with sealer wands, using people spraying underneath the bodies, using people to spray the car, on and on. They don't even wet sand cars anymore. It's just touch-up work if they see a defect or something like that. Back then, they actually literally wet sanded the entire body of the car. The first thing that comes to mind was the place. It just stunk because you had them fumes you had to deal with. And that was, I guess, my first reaction to it is, PU. It just stunk.
Marilyn Coulter.
Gary, in working in the paint department, was it summertime or wintertime, or did that make a difference on the fumes, and did the heat make a difference at all working up there?
Yeah, the heat, obviously, because of all the ovens back then, they had the paint ovens that baked the paint and everything else, was worse. I mean, almost, it was terrible in the summertime. And the smells seemed to get exasperated in the summer. I mean, they just intensified in the summertime. I was happy, because I was in there during the summertime when I leveled off, and I was happy. I shouldn't say happy, but it didn't bother me much going to the wet deck, because that was the coolest spot in the paint shop. You'd have a little horseplay and spray each other with paint with water. So, but no, it was much worse up there in the summertime than in the winter.
Well, bring forth a couple of questions. The other one I wanted to ask, when you talk about the environment and the heat and all this apparatus that you had to put on, how did that work for your breaks and your lunches, and how did the fumes affect your eating, all that stuff?
You just stepped out of the booth, and of course you'd see the guys strolling around because he had everything. You'd untape your gloves and eat your sandwich because you didn't have enough time with the break times allowed to get out of your. Matter of fact, even at lunch, I didn't disrobe to get out of that stuff. You just had it on and took your gloves off and your hood off, and like I say, back then they just pumped oxygen to you to help you breathe in there. So it was miserable.
Doug Rademacher. So Gary, you're first hired in, you heard about the place from your uncle, you end up in the trim department. Tell me about the people, your first day, your first week. What'd you think of building automobiles? And share a little of that.
Back then, and it probably had a lot to do with, again, certain things kind of direct you in life. And back then, I was amazed. I spoke my little brief experience at Eugene Welding with the union. When I hired in there, as good as that job was, and I'm a young man thinking, man, I just died and went to heaven because, installing vinyl tops, not every car was a vinyl top. We had back then, I think, five or six teams of four-piece people to a team to install the vinyl top. It was a great job, I thought. The senior members didn't think so, and had committee calls into their committeemen. Jim Schock was the guy's name. I remember, a big old guy. He came up, and I thought, as a new hire, I would join my fellow brothers in complaining about the job, and those guys knew enough about it, and they took care enough of the younger workers then that, and I hope they still do now, I don't know, but they said, hey, listen, the last thing we need is a new hire putting in a committee call, because the company will say, hey, look, even he's got a call in, and he don't know what the hell he's doing. He's just been here, you know, X amount, 90 days or 30 days, whatever the hell it was. So they just basically said, no, Gary, you're not putting a call in. We'll take care of this. And that, you know, I mean, it was a good feeling knowing that these guys had it figured out, and I was looking forward to, you know, making the job even better. And they won that grievance and won the 78, and it ended up happening to where they had people that sprayed the vinyl tops. They settled it that rather than the team going over and getting the vinyl tops, the people that were spraying the vinyl tops delivered them to the car and put them on the car, and then we just stepped up to the car. That was the resolve of the 78. So, you know, it was, I tell you, the guys, everybody I worked with looked out after you. I mean, it was a true brotherhood, if you will. There wasn't any, at that time, there wasn't any women on the day shift that did vinyl tops, but there was on night shift. And it was, you know, it left a good feeling. And the people, I've said at the time, the people were the greatest part of the job. I mean, they made the boring, monotonous work bearable. Without the people, I don't think I would have hung out.
Now, you said the word 78. Now, can you share, obviously you started out in the 70s when you hired in, but what is a 78 that you're referring to?
Oh, a 78, paragraph 78 of the National Agreement is a work standards grievance that, you know, each member over there would be able to say, to call their committee man and complain about having too much work. And it was called a 78. So after paragraph 78, so it was a work standard grievance that any member could raise his hand and say, hey, I think I got too much work, boss, and get the union involved and take it from there.
You talked a little bit about the people being the greatest part of going to work. Can you tell us, was there any particular initiations for a guy like you or for the new blood?
No, I you wouldn't have known. I mean, if there was, you know, no, I wasn't treated any different than anybody else. When Friday rolled along, I got invited out. I guess I knew I belonged with the old boys. When Friday afternoon rolled along, they always went out to lunch and had a beer or two, and it just felt good. Here I am, you know, 20 years old, and these older guys said, hey, come on, kid, let's go have a beer. And I guess I knew I fit in at that point, but short of going out on a Friday afternoon and having a beer with the guys, no, they treated me just as good as anybody, as one of their own that's been there forever. Like I say, even to the point with the story I just shared, that they were looking out for me, and in turn looking out for themselves, because they were real clear to point out that we don't need no new hire complaining about the workload.
Can you tell me, do you remember a person in particular that taught you your job or that showed you the ropes?
Yeah, Ray Fish, Don Rathburn. Jeez, years have slipped. Yeah, there was a host of them. When I got to nights, because I was on nights for so much longer, I bonded with those guys more than I did the brief time I was on days. But those guys that were on days, I guess, rose in the ranks of the local union, always stayed in touch with them, considered them good friends, and still bump into them at times at farm auctions and different events that I go to.
You're sharing that continuation of friends and stuff that you've made. Did you hire in with a group of people, or were you hired in individually?
No, actually, the day I hired in, there was seven of us hired that day. And it was, you know, you almost felt like you were at a cattle auction. You know, I spoke of Jim Bean. I remember him walking in. They walked me out. Then he was called the general supervisor. I remember sitting in the general supervisor's office, and Jim Beam walked in, you come with me, and that was it. So.
And you followed like a sheep.
Yeah, I followed him on out to the vinyl top area.
Okay. Let's. Since you did spend how many years in the body plant?
Well, I just went on international staff 7 years ago, so I from 76 to 99. So 23 years, I guess.
Did it ever amaze you the fact that certain people hired into the plant, went to their job, got their paycheck, and never changed jobs? Did you...
Oh, yeah.
Think about those people.
Yeah, my Uncle Joe. Even today, as I argue with corporations across the country, I use my Uncle Joe story because he it just amazed me. As I was on my cupcake job with no seniority, I'd walk up and see my Uncle Joe, who at the time had 28 years seniority when I hired in. And he was bolting in seatbelts. And I'm thinking, my God, you know, I mean, just a miserable job to where he had to turn into the car. And, you know, then you had a big, heavy old gun with a rod, and it just going until you locked the seatbelt bolt in. And, you know, that'd be full of filler, or not filler, but sealer and stuff like that. And I thought to myself, you know, Uncle Joe, you got 28 years. I'm sitting down there working on every sixth job when a vinyl top comes along, which would relate to probably about every 12th job, and he's in there every car bolting in seatbelts, and it just amazed me, you know. And I talked to him, and you know, at times he was the kind of worker that just came to work and kept his mouth shut, and the supervisor would reward him. There was a switching job where cars got marshaled. My Uncle Joe never put an app in for the, or a transfer in for the job or anything else. But every once in a while, the supervisor would kind of reward him, and he'd go up and control, which was just pushing buttons as these cars got marshaled through and then sent on over to the Oldsmobile. And, you know, it, to him, that was his reward. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, as I grew up in the business, I always wondered why no one ever complained that my Uncle Joe got that job on occasion. You know, because as I come through, I understood, you know, absentee replacement workers and everything else. But back then, it was it appeared to every worker in the area, well, Joe never complains, and that's just what they did back then. Nobody raised a stink about it. But he retired. When the day he retired, he was bolting in seatbelts. And if you see the guy today, he walks, you know, with a, you know, with one shoulder hanging down, and I know why he walks the way he does. It was years of bolting in seatbelts and turning that today he, you know, I know why he walks that way, but the average Joe wouldn't. So yeah, it always amazed me, and you know, and not only my Uncle Joe, there's a whole host of people that would do jobs that would have caused me to leave the place. I would have quit the place. I'm thinking, how can you do this day in and day out, day in and day out? But I guess you just get in the groove, you know. And having said that, I certainly wasn't blessed to have the best job my whole career. There were days that I struggled with, you know, doing that. And, you know, I guess I self-medicated, you know. I mean, I got through it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you had said you did the job down in the paint department where you were taped in, and so you had your days of those jobs, and you just kind of look back as you were able to get back to your other job that somebody did that every day.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I always thought, you know, the transfer process, and in my earlier days as a committee man in there, I would always, you know, a lot of people would call and complain about, you know, and I would always tell people, hey, this thing works. You know, if you need help putting in the transfer, I'll help you. But, you know, that was really the light at the end of the tunnel for people that said, hey, I want off this job. And, you know, it did work.
Did you, you worked there during a number of name changes. It went from Fisher Body to the BOC Buicles Cadillac Group. We closed down in the end of this last year as Lansing Car Assembly. What's your, what's the building to you?
It's always be Fisher Body, you know. I started talking, you know, I hired into Fisher Body. It'll always be Fisher Body. I used to, I wrote a lot when I was in elected positions, and I would let the membership know, you know, while some ex-executive might be in the sign business and they're enriching him, this place will always be Fisher Body. And as the place changed names, as that kind of stuff happened, I believe people started losing identity with, I mean, to me, there was always a pride that I worked at Fisher Body. And you know, I could talk for hours on why that was. And it was based on probably my involvement with the union and knowing what working conditions and what things were like across at the Olds. I mean, there was a pride in Fisher Body. I was always, and still believe it to this day, that the union was stronger at Fisher Body than it was anywhere else in town. We were the first, you know, UAW local in town. And there was just a level of pride with Fisher Body. And you know, I always, I carry that to this day. And, you know, I'm an international rep today, and you'd be surprised the number of offices I step into that have Fisher Body memorabilia in them. And that just tells me there's a whole lot of people that feel the same way I did about the pride of Fisher Body to their taking it to their new offices down at Solidarity House and having Fisher Body memorabilia in them. So it was just a pride, I think, that I certainly had. And you know, and it wasn't just because, you know, I mentioned my Uncle Joe. I had another uncle. My Uncle Bob worked in the place and retired out of the place. And he worked in the body shop. And, you know, I mean, I don't know. There was just a pride in Fisher Body that I think we've lost that identity. And that's too bad.
Marilyn Coulter.
Gary, I'd like to take you back to the night shift in the trim department. I know you said you had a lot of friends that still extended, and you know, a lot of times we call each other like union brother and sister, so it's kind of like family. And you being a young man and a young family man and working on nights, how did young people make it through working night shift? Can you take us through what it was like working in the plant, being young?
It was, you know, earlier in my career, and I'm talking 70s, early 80s, you know, I didn't start a family until I was, I was married, I guess, 8 or 9 years before we started a family. So I didn't have them struggles that they did, not being able to be at family events and everything else. But I'd hear it, and the beauty of it was back then, there wasn't the competition or the competitiveness in foreign car builders that there is today. And back then it was easy enough. If I didn't want to work that day, I mean, there were literally times I would get into work an hour early to run into the supervisors. Back then they had desks, they didn't have offices or anything, they had desks right out in the area, and there was a sheet of paper that if you wanted the day off and you were the first one to put your name on that list, there was a good chance you'd get the day off. And you know, they were much more understanding. You know, there was, you know, back then, and I felt it was going to move to where we'd have a day off a month. We had these things called PPH days, which stands for paid personal holidays. And it was almost, it was better than Christmas. I remember in the shop, the day they passed out, the supervisors, you were more excited about getting your PPH slip than you were your paycheck that night, because you then knew what days you were going to have off the next year. And it was, you know, it was neat things we had at that time. Unfortunately, they're gone now, like I say, due to how competitive the industry's gotten. But, you know, because of the extra manpower, people were able to get the night off. And you know, it wasn't shutting down production. But, you know, we'd have an area of say, 30 to 35 people in a supervisor's area. And it was nothing to have five or six, you know, they call them everything from extra board, utility, absentee replacement over the years. Back then, I think they were called extra board. There was nothing to have five or six extra board people in a supervisor's area for absentee replacement, vacation replacement, whatever the case may be. So, you know, I guess people were able to get out then, unlike what I've seen as my career has went on. You certainly, I doubt like hell if there's a sign-up sheet at a supervisor's desk anymore to get the day off. So.
What about on those nights when you couldn't get out, but you were on a team that worked every sixth job? Did you read, listen to music, play cards? What did you do?
Oh yeah, we enjoyed gambling. We did quite a bit of gambling back in the Vinyl Top area. You know, and there was a lot of neat things. Andy Graham, Michelle Penfield. we did a lot of things to break the monotony. And you know, I mean, the cars would come through an oven, and I remember Michelle and Andy, we would cook in this oven as the cars come through. We made little metal shells, and every time, you know, some quality thing would pop up, why they would say, oh, it's the damn cooking back in the ovens. Well, it only came through the oven there to, you know, to heat up the car so the glue would adhere to the top. Back in further where they came through the paint ovens, I mean, come Christmas time and Thanksgiving time, we were baking hams and we were cooking turkeys back in those. Them were the paint ovens. And the guys that worked there and the ladies that worked there, it was like a whole different recipe that they knew how long it had to be in them ovens, where the hot spots were in the ovens. We go out at lunchtime and buy a bunch of Poli sausage and onions and cut them up and put them in that oven as they came out of the paint shop, and we were chowing down. Like I say, we gambled a lot. We used to, during our when we didn't have a job going on, and everybody helped everybody out. If they seen you were on a street gambling, why, somebody else would step up on the job and you'd catch them later. But we used to pitch nickels against the wall, and there might be five or six of us pitching these nickels against the wall. And of course, whoever had the nickel closest to the wall scraped up the money. And that elevated the quarters and everything else. So it was, you know, we just did things to, like I say, forget, you know, and I can't emphasize, even today, you know, I mean, while, you know, the auto workers get beat up that they make too much, I mean, you know, I challenge people to stand on that assembly line and do that, not for a day, but do it for weeks and months, and you know, the boring, monotonous work that is involved in assembly line work, you got to find some relief. I fought it back when they were saying, you know, this silly stuff, and thank God I never did witness it. Again today, because of my job, I see it in factories where newspapers are banned, magazines are banned, and even when I had the worst jobs, you know, because I wasn't always on vinyl, I had bad jobs in trim shop. Even when I was on them, you had the little bit of a reprieve by going to a book or to a paper and being able to only read maybe a paragraph, but you would be able to catch up and at least break the mindset of you know, the boring and monotonous work. So,
Earl Nicholson.
Gary, as a new hire and as you progressed over your years in the factory, what was your relationship with skilled trades, and how did you interact with them?
Well, my first experience with trades was when I got elected full-time district committeeman in the trim shop. And they redistrict, which the shop committee would name what a district was going to look like. So you had roughly 250 people that you would represent as a district committeeman. My first experience with them was when they redistrict, there was a mindset then to try to give everybody a little bit of overtime that was in a union, a full-time union job. Well, in order to accommodate that desire, they give us the the wastewater treatment plant and the powerhouse. And that was my first experience. I'm a production worker. I go out and I take a committee call from a person in the powerhouse, and they start spilling out all this doubling back and that they were losing money, and on and on and on and on they went. And it had nothing to do with the workload. I certainly witnessed it. It seemed like they had a good job. I used to, one of our past presidents, Elvin Presley, why he changed light bulbs in the place, and I always used to hoot on him. I wasn't shy when I was on the assembly line of abusing clipboard jobs or whatever the case may be. I was probably more radical. And as these people went by, I would holler out, hey, get a job, you know, because I knew I was, I affectionately call it chasing the chain. I knew I was chained to that line, and I wasn't going nowhere, but I'm watching these people. Al was one. You know, I'm thinking, what do you do? Well, I change light bulbs, and I thought, my God, what a great job. I'm busting my ass on this assembly line, and you're riding around in a cart, you know, maybe changing a light bulb a day. I don't know. It didn't look like he changed very many to me. And when I got out and I represented them workers in the powerhouse, I was kind of half-assed insulted. That they were so damn worried about their paycheck, and the powerhouse, I mean, it almost looked like you were stepping in a cafeteria back then. They had great work environment, and I guess maybe I was envious, but I never really had the desire to go into trades. I mean, there was a program. Today, looking back, I probably regret it because, you know, as you see what's happening, the structural change going on in the industry, to have a trade is invaluable versus, well, geez, I worked in a factory for 20 years as an assembly line worker, and if the world falls to pieces, what do they have? Where the tradespeople actually had a trade where they could go out and do it. But probably, I guess in a nutshell, Earl, just maybe jealousy, maybe pissed off, but they certainly didn't seem like they carried their weight. And nah, not all of them. But another example, as a committee man, I used to have members in the trim shop complain that the fan up on the roof would be off every time they came in, obviously in the summertime. And I'd get committee calls every, you know, beginning of the shift. People are complaining about the fan not being turned on. Well, you had to go up into a powerhouse or whatever the hell it was up on the roof to turn that fan on. And the electrician, finally, after I raised so much hell, went to the skilled trades zone at the time and raised hell about this, you know, turning this fan on. The tradesman came to me and said, hey, listen, why don't you have your guys go up and turn the fan on? Well, that was easy enough. I went to the repairman at the time that was in the supervisor's area. And the repairman was more than willing to go up there because he didn't want to relieve the people on the line as they were bitching to me about the fan not being on, because I would obviously get every committee call. And so he said, hell yeah, I'll go up there and turn that thing on. It beats the hell out of, you know, relieving all these people for committee calls. And it wasn't until they started cutting back on electricians that same zone committee man came to me, and the same electrician that at that time couldn't be bothered with going up there and turning that fan on, said, hey, bullshit, that's my job. Their production's doing my job, and we need to change this thing around. And again, that might have been one of the mindsets that, you know, well, what are we, you know, chopped liver here on production workers? And so, I don't know. Half of it, like I say, was jealousy. Half of it was, I was pissed off because they thought they were some sort of prima donna. And over my years, you know, the mindset, I used to battle with these guys that the mindset was, I had one particular, the mindset was that, hey, if I don't put my shoes on today, General Motors makes money. That, you know, they thought as long as they were sitting on their butt doing nothing, that it was okay. And meanwhile, production, I mean, obviously you can tell I was a production worker, still think like a production worker, always will, but it just always pissed me off. And again, whether it was anger or whether it was jealousy, I couldn't quite tell you, Earl.
So now that we've gone through that, I'd have to ask you the question, has Skilled Trades ever done a government job for you?
In the plant, when I was in the plant, no. Since leaving to go to the international, yeah, I've got some beautiful things. I got this clock that the skilled trades workers in Anderson, Indiana made me that after I got done negotiating their national agreement that they gave me it is just beautiful. It's all out of stainless steel. It's got UAW International Rep, Gary Bernath on the face of it, all, you know, however they cut it into it, probably with a laser or something. But yeah, since I've been on the job as an international rep, I've had several government jobs, and they were always tokens of appreciation, but in the plant, no.
Marilyn Coulter.
And that was probably because I never asked for one. So.
Gary, what I wanted to ask you was that now, since we've talked a lot about your union activity and you were on the line and you were vocal about certain things, what I want to know is a couple of things. Number one, two-part question. Number one, what made a good supervisor for you and what made a bad supervisor? But then the other thing about it was, what got you to saying, I want to be union, I want to get active in the union? And how that happened? Did you and your friends do it? Kind of take us on that journey a little bit.
Yeah, I guess to the tune of what makes a good and a bad supervisor, and it ties into why I got involved with the union. A good supervisor always stood up for his employees, and I've seen that through my entire. I see it today. They always would stand up and take care of their employees. Whether it be that night off I talked about, or whether it be, you know, no, I'm not going to discipline him. He's a good worker. He comes in every day, just because he went out and maybe had one too many beers at lunch or whatever. That they would always, you know, take the employee's position and wouldn't kowtow to the general supervisor. And actually, what got me involved in the union. There was two systems back in the old days. One system, the A system, built Cutlasses, and the B system built the 88s and 98s and these Tornados. And it seemed, well, it didn't seem, it was a plain simple fact that the worst supervision was on the A system. And because of, you know, seniority, flow rights, and everything else, whenever my job, because it was a good job, be it, you know, I always refer to my installing vinyl tops, but it went beyond that. I moved to other jobs because then I got more seniority and could get the transfer. Whenever I went to the A system, supervisors such as Orville Gray and John, what was John's, the real asshole?
John Powers.
I mean, it just seemed like the mindset down on the A system was 180 of where I was. And the B system supervisors kind of let things, you know, they stood up for the employees. It didn't seem like they were nitpicking, being a major pain in the ass, but whenever I went down the A system, they were. And I only ran for union positions when I was down on the A system. I first started out, Joe Cerna was, a matter of fact, Marilyn, you were in that area. I always said I got elected by my check pool, and I was always pissed because my check pool would always run about 21 people, and when I first got elected, I only got 13 votes, and I was pissed at my check pool people because I said, you guys couldn't even get over and vote. But that's when I got involved with the union, was when I was down on the A system. And there was a time that when recall rights permitted me to go back to the B system, my work environment was much more pleasant up there, that I actually resigned my union position because of the transfer back to the B system. And then I plopped down to the A system again. Union opportunity arose. I put my name on a hat again because it leveled the playing field with the likes of a John Powers and an Orville Gray and stuff, that I could take them on equal footing and make their life as miserable as they made mine and the members at the time. You know, I mean, I wasn't that well thought of by management people when I was in the union position. So that's what got me involved, is whenever I went to the A system, I hated the way they operated, and I'd run for a union position. And like I say, to get on that equal footing and make their life as miserable as they made mine.
You also had the opportunity to run up the union ladder. Yeah. Can you go through that for us a little bit, all the different positions you held?
Yeah, actually I was fortunate And being an old politician, my flyers would read as such, that I would say I was elected too. As a lot of people would say on their union flyers that they served. But I was fortunate that I got elected to more terms than I actually served. So on my union flyers, I would say, you know, I was elected to, and I was elected to three times alternate committee man, and I was elected three times district committee man. I did serve two full terms as a district, and then I when we had midterm elections, and that's something unique about our local union that I may touch on later. But the shop committee was elected separate from the district committee, and while some on the shop committee, when they get there, they don't like that because they thought all the districts had a free shot at their job. And I still would argue today, and I hope it's still that way today, that really brings on the strongest and best candidates for a position. And, you know, we shouldn't have a system set up to where it favors the incumbent, you know. But enough on that. I did three terms alternate committeeman, three terms district committeeman, and then the end term there, the shop committee came up. Good friends encouraged me to run, and I had no desire. Fact of it is, I was going to run for, what the hell was it? Some cheesy job. I don't know. It was one, maybe guide or something. I don't know. It wasn't nothing. Nothing that I was actually going to have an opportunity to further the cause, if you will, of that membership and their plight that they're going through every day. It was some standing committee job. And not that they don't advance causes, they certainly do, but it certainly isn't at the level of a bargainer. I mean, that's where the rubber meets the road. And so then they come to me and they said, hey, Gary, screw that. You know, what are you going to do for us there? You need to run for shop committee. Good friends, actually Mike Roach and Joe Lau were the ones that were my strongest advocates, encouraging me to run for shop committee. And back then, the old guard, you know, they certainly didn't want to see anybody knocking on their door. You know, the Curly Joneses, the Ron Allmans, Terry Wards, I can go on and on with a list of people that, Ron Perry for that sake, you know, and a lot of people, a lot of people didn't want to see any young upstart get into that position. And I guess I was blessed at that point that I ran, that enough people that I represented at the district level had moved to day shift, and they knew, or they at least appreciated what I was able to do for them when I was their district. And I got their vote, and I got elected shop committee. I did one term as shop committee. Probably my proudest moment was walking that membership out on a strike. That's another sordid story, but we walked that membership out. I was a member of the shop committee when that happened, and I was proud about that. I articulated my feelings very clearly to the membership, much to the chagrin of again, my fellow shop committee members, who thought I ought not be doing that. And, you know, life went on. Then in 93, I was blessed by the membership to get elected president, of which I did for two terms. Until I got asked from, regional director, Cal Rapson, was a big influence to get me a job. The offer came from Dick Shoemaker to go on staff. So that was it. 3 years as an alternate, 3 years as a district, elected two. 3 years as an alternate, 3 years as a district, one term as a shop committee, and then two terms as president.
Under your time as president of Local 602, what would you say might be a couple of the things that you were most proud of as being able to implement for your work?
I think probably if I had to zero back in on one thing that I knew I had direct impact in was the fixing up of, I call it the old girl, the Union Hall over there. You know, right away, which, and it was interesting, right away, I thought the place needed some sprucing up, and, you know, I used to call it the door to nowhere. It's still there, but I said, well, we can fix that. We'll plant a bush that'll cover up that door. And when I planted it, obviously it didn't, but I look over there now and that door is covered up. But, you know, I mean, I didn't mind. I figured the membership was paying me good money. And I didn't mind picking up a sledgehammer. I'd wear blue jeans and a t-shirt into work. And I remember with David Wayne, he wasn't too excited about swinging a sledgehammer to bust open to bust out the sidewalk that led to nowhere. And I was more than happy to go out there and swing that sledgehammer and you know, actually contribute both by the ideas and physically to fixing up the Union Hall. And I was blessed, you know, with was able to articulate what my thoughts were to the e-board, and they were on board with it. I mean, everybody understood that, yeah, that place needed fixing up. And we redid the whole hall from the top to bottom, put in new offices for the chairman, put in a new shop committee room downstairs. I mean, we did, I guess for my brief time there, that was the major accomplishment. I mean, there was a whole lot of other little things that I had an opportunity to influence and make happen, but that was probably the most visible thing that I can walk, step back and say, wow, I had a piece of that.
You also, being the zone, and I know you said that you walked them out on strike, so that's one of the things you were proud about, but can you tell us about some of the things that zone you did, and then tell us a little bit about the strike. Why'd you go out? How long were you out? Things like that, please.
Yeah. The a lot of things with the zone that I was proud of is I felt I brought fair and equal representation from a zone to both shifts, because I worked night shift until I actually got elected zone, and I got elected to zone in 1990. So you're looking at 14 years that I spent my whole career on night shift and knew the woes and the plight of a night shift worker, if you will. That when I got elected zone, I did several things, actually. Was adamant about the fact that I was going to begin punching in. Back then, and not to destroy any involvement of shop committee before then, but back then, bottom line, they cut a fat hog and had it to where the shop committeemen didn't have to ring in and out. And I was a young junior one, and I was being pummeled because who the hell you think you are, Bernath? You're coming in here and you're ringing in and out. Well, I had one thing on my side, I felt, was the contract, the national agreement that shows you will ring in and out. I said, you know, just because you guys cut the fat hog. Now, remember, I was the young junior member. I shouldn't say so young. There was actually a woman, Renita Taylor, was on shop committeeman. She was shop committee a couple turns before I was. But I was the one that just said, hey, you all do what you want to do. I'm going to ring in. I'm going to ring out. Well, that led to a whole lot of arguments amongst my fellow shop committee people. And it ended up they cut a hog to where they showed one ring, and that made it legal. It did make it legal by the national agreement. And they were able to, I guess, do whatever they thought they had to do. So that was my rocky start. And then I also told them all that, hey, you know, I noticed we're getting paid. When I first come on, we were getting paid 11 hours a day. And I said, I noticed we're getting paid 11 hours a day. No ring-ins or outs, but I'm going to ring in and out, and I'm going to split my shift. I'm going to work, 5 hours on days, 5 hours on nights. Well, that pissed a lot of them off because, they thought they had, I guess, the membership convinced that this shop committeeman job was really a daytime job. Even though R.T. Taylor, I would submit, probably spent the most of her time on nights when she was, like I say, she was shop committee before I got there, and she spent the majority of her time on nights, and obviously she knew where her political base was too, and so she kept her hours there. So I was happy that and that pissed them off. Well, then also I began communicating regularly with my zone, and I had a focus that I was going to put out a quarterly letter to my zone and tell them how many grievances were in the process, what steps they were at, what we as a union were doing. Well, that pissed them off. What the hell are you trying to do? You're playing politics all the damn time, and all I said is, no, I'm trying to keep the membership informed. And, I kept that as I moved on. When I got the president, I put the perspective out on a weekly basis. Before it was like a quarterly thing, and that hit and miss. I really focused on communicating with the workers to try to build that pride in the union that I felt was sorely missing with our membership. So communications was a big, big thing for me. And then again, as I say, the cream de la cream was was in 92 when there was a dispute over what the hell was it? Mass versus tag relief. We had it.
Gary, would you share with us again about the proud moment as a shop committee where you said you the decision was made and you led the people out of the plant? Can you tell us about that? Was that a strike or was that, what exactly happened?
Yeah, it was, we hadn't yet resolved, management wanted to go to tag relief, and that got to be the fashionable thing across the corporation.
And what is that?
Tag relief would be, they wanted to go to mass relief. We had tag relief. Tag relief was where you had a relief man, which, oh, by the way, from a production worker's perspective, that was one of the good jobs, you know, that you could aspire to be a relief man sometime and have one of these good jobs where you bounce around and give everybody their relief time in accordance with the national agreement. So we had tag relief. Management wanted to go to mass relief because they knew they could do away, in our instance, the number comes to my mind, of over 300 jobs by going to mass relief. Just that, then they would just shut the line down for the 15 minutes, 16 minutes, whatever the case may be, and everybody would have relief at the same time. Many tackies come at us. I was on the shop committee, as I say, at that time, that, you know, old people that go to this wouldn't ever go back to tag relief, and, you know, they just missed the point, that, from my mind, that those were good jobs. That was the high seniority people were the relief men. Them were the good jobs to where somebody could aspire, a production worker could aspire to say, yeah, I want to transfer to be a relief man. So I really looked at it as, no, it's more than whether or not I can sit down with Joe and Mary and chit-chat during my relief time or play a hand of euchre during my relief time. It was, you're wiping out good jobs. And I found that much more offensive than whether or not. And guess what? When we had tag relief, you tended to go visit somebody that was on the line and chat with them anyways as they were working. You know, it wasn't like I had to have this mass shutdown to have a good time for 16 minutes. Like I say, it was a loss of those good jobs that I found more offensive. So management was hell bound to do that. We had it in our local agreement. It was local agreement language we stood on. And said, no, our local agreement calls for tag relief, and we're not going to allow you guys in midterm. It wasn't like we were up for a local agreement or anything. In midterm, just wipe out these relief men. And you know, then we were struggling too, as we still do today, the loss of jobs. You know, and I mean, it was a big deal. It was a big deal for me, and I believe it was a big deal for my whole shop committee. Or my whole shop committee, because we didn't get there. Obviously, I didn't get there alone. As things progressed, Jim Zubkis was the plant manager. And I had a good relationship with the plant manager, and still do today. I mean, we still stay in touch and friends. And I told Zub then, as a junior member, I said, Zub, we're walking. And he goes, no, you're not, Gary. You guys ain't going to walk. I said, Zub, I'm telling you, we're going to walk. Now, obviously, part of mine was a bluff, because I had no clue whether we were going to walk or not. These negotiations for what they wanted to do, eliminating the tag relief, went on for probably 3 or 4 weeks. There's a process that the regional international rep comes in and debates the issues. Then Solidarity House will send an international rep in to debate the issues. And then the day we walked out, Steve Jokic was the president of vice president of the GM department. He sent in the guy I work for now, Cal Rapson, was his top AA, administrative assistant, and he came in, and a lot of people probably don't know it, I guess probably old news now, but when the final push came down to whether or not we were going to strike over this issue, the shop committee was divided. It was actually the final vote about whether or not we were going to walk was 3 shop committee members said walk, and 4 said settle. Vice President, or Cal Rapson, said, I'm not going to divide this shop committee this way. A lot of tense moments. I mean, you know, a lot goes through your head when you know you're walking a membership out that door on a strike. A lot of tense moments, a lot of interesting stories. I won't get into it this time, but it was tough times for us. And thank God Cal had the wisdom to not divide that shop committee. Well, as it progressed and it got down to that Friday morning when we set the strike deadline at 10 o'clock in the morning, as it got down to that morning, they picked off one of the three. So now it was only two shop committee members, myself and, R.T. Taylor was the other one, that said, no, we want to walk. So now it got down, there it is, 9:30 in the morning, the international at Cal Rapson says, I'm leaving. Y'all talk about it. Dick Bennett was the chairman at the time and Ted Hartman was the president. He says, you all talk about it and I'll be back. So a lot of words, a lot of heavy debate and discussions, a lot of hollering and arguing and fighting took on at that time. They take a vote. Ron Perry was actually the third one that they picked off. And I say they, the four that said no, don't strike. Had everybody had the district's position to walk the floor, tell everybody to shut her down, we're walking, everything was in place. We take that final vote, it now is a 5-2 vote. And I'm sitting there now as a junior member on the shop committee thinking, oh my God, you know, I can't believe we're rolling over on this one. Cal comes back into the room and says, he came back in, talked lightly for a few moments. He could tell there were some hurt feelings, if you will. He pulls Dick Bennett and Ted Hartman out, says, well, what was the vote? And Bennett said, it's now 5-2. Cal made a phone call to Stephen Jokic, and Cal came back into that room. Dick Bennett and Ted Hartman came back in, and were kind of smug about the fact that, you know, we're not walking, you know, chill out, Bernath, it's not going to happen. I'll never forget the feeling I had when after Cal talked to Stephen Jokic and he came back into that room with one of our local 602 t-shirts on, I hollered out yes, because I knew that shirt was on for a reason. He knew we were going to walk out that gate. He knew the media was going to be out there. Reuben Burks had already lined it up with buses to be out there to support the members and the shop committee when they walked out of that front gate, and we were going to go out on strike. And I thought to myself, and I was being somewhat selfish, I said, my God, we do have an international union. The strike ended up lasting only, I guess it was 4 days. We were back to work Tuesday. And you know, it ended up that it was settled over the issue that we would let the membership vote on mass versus tag. I immediately got out the pen and started writing letters to the membership. I remember the phrase I used because I'd spent some time at NUMMI as a shop committeeman, GM at the time. NUMMI was a joint venture with Toyota, that they were taking a lot of the leadership from local unions out to Fremont, California, and showing them the NUMMI way of doing business, or the Toyota production system. And I remember what I said in the letter. There were several things I said in the letter, but I said, you know, vote to humanize the workplace, not numanize the workplace. And fortunately, we won that. And I remember the shop committee again coming up to me. Ron Perry, a good friend of mine, said, Gary, you're biting off more than you can chew. You should not be going out there telling the people how to vote and this and that. I remember when the vote got taken, the personnel director, Jim Gaunt, called Dick Bennett at the time. And I remember this like it happened yesterday. I was sitting at my desk. Dick Bennett answers the phone. Or actually, he didn't answer the phone. It was given to him. And RT answered the phone. I think she said, well, it's Jim Gaunt. And this was just after the vote. Now, management played such a part in trying to get the people. I mean, I never seen nothing like it. They shut the line down. They treated our members like they were a bunch of idiots. They didn't know where the union hall was. If you would have seen it, there were signs posted throughout the plant that management put up with arrows pointing to where the union hall was, how to get to the union hall. And I they took their tactic and tried to sway the vote their way. And it just pissed me off more that I would come the other way and try to get people to say no, vote for tag relief. We did it, and the membership, thank God, voted to keep tag. And then that rolled on to something that I affectionately called the rest of my career Bloody April. That was when management come back at us again and basically threw out threats of no future product, you know, like they typically do, unless you guys do away with this tag relief. And I refer to it Bloody April because we went through that struggle. It seemed like we ended that struggle in October. The vote was either the end of October or 1st of November. And the membership supported, you know, their desire, and which I thought was their desire, to keep tag relief. And it was that next April, April of 93, that management then come back at us again. And unfortunately, we lost we lost tag relief and then went to mass relief. But it was certainly a proud moment that, you know, even my brother today, who works at the Olds, said, well, you know, and he's even said, you know, at least you had the feeling of doing that. And I think it's a deep-seated feeling of everybody on that assembly line to just say, there, take that, you know, and walk out of that place. And I don't take that lightly, but I think there was a lot of hoops and hollering at the point that they seen their local union leadership standing up and saying, no, bullshit, you ain't going to do this. And it was, like I say, certainly a proud part of my leadership, local leadership time.
So. Gary, Judy.
Oh, I'd like to add that even the Wall Street Journal supported you in that effort.
Oh, yeah.
Conservative business paper stated that it wasn't necessary, and it was management's fault that we went out on strike. And if we would have had better management in the plant, that strike never would have happened.
Yep, so, you're right, Gary. The fact of it is, I still got that article. I still read the Wall Street Journal today. Some people question me doing that, but I still read that. And I got that article because you're right. They said due to local management blunders, that thing never would have happened. I mean, it was mishandled by management locally. Me and Zub, I had some fun with that. You know, I was touching on Jim Gaunt calling down there, and I'll never forget it, that Dick answered the phone. And I'll never forget what Dick said. He said, you sure you want to talk to him? And I was sitting at my desk in the work center. And when Dick said that, you know, I didn't think he was even wanting to talk to me. But Dick Bennett, the chairman at the time, handed me the phone. And the PD says, congratulations, you won. And, you know, I mean, that just showed the mindset of management that time. I mean, it wasn't about me winning. I mean, it was about keeping them good jobs. And, you know, I mean, you know, I understood that was a good job in a trim shop, but I remember that local personnel director saying, congratulations, you won. And I responded to him. I said, well, no, Jim, it wasn't about you losing or me winning. It was about the jobs and the good jobs that a production worker can aspire to, and that's where I was at. But
Doug Rademacher. Gary, did you attend union meetings all along?
No. I actually, when I first got elected, my first time I got elected alternate committeeman was in 81. And then it was a requirement to attend. I never did attend a union meeting. I remember as when I first hired in, and it was due to my union experience at Eugene Welding, that I did walk over. Bob Summers was the president at the time, and I walked over and introduced myself to Bob Summers and said, hey, you know, I believe in the union. Shared my little story with him about Eugene Welding. He appeared. He was kind, but it wasn't like, "Hey, brother, come along. We got something for you." Then the union was really. I shouldn't say this because I didn't know and I didn't try cracking them doors open, but it really appeared to me like a close knit club, you know, that will decide who is going to move along and who will and who won't. And you know, and having said that, I would also add that, you know, that's another proud point I have is that we never, well, that was, back then there was caucus politics, but that got broken up, thank God, and it appeared as if we didn't have caucus politics as a local union, and that is, I think, a credit to our union and to our membership. I remember union flyers out there that the anti-caucus would attack people who were trying to run, they said as a slate, but it was a caucus. And we would, those that didn't believe in caucuses would attack them to say, well, we don't need caucuses. We had them here once. You remember what it was like then. So we played a lot of games back and forth. You know, politics are politics, you know.
Do you vote in all elections, and have you...
Never miss. Never miss. Local union elections, fact of it is, I even used to come back and vote for my district when I first went on staff, and I've been instructed that that's not quite too proper. So I get back for the e-board. I'll be back. I know we got our constitutional convention election coming up. I still stay in touch with the local via the internet. And you know, I used to give Art a hard time because when I was there, and I don't know, I think it was probably more because we had such a long-serving president or secretary to the president, but we would always send any information about the locals. Maryland would always send out to the past presidents that were still alive. And I think it was really a connectiveness that they always felt comfortable about just coming up. Be it Bob Summers, Oscar Wade, you know, a host of presidents that were there before would feel comfortable coming up and be able to have a conversation with a sitting president because we always kept them in the loop. And I used to beat up Art. I said, hey, Art, I don't get the perspective anymore. You know, when I first moved on, I'd gotten the perspective. It was once a month. Maryland would stuff four of them in an envelope and send it to me as a past president. And, you know, that's gone now. I don't suffer from it because I've got access to the internet, but I'm sure Bob Summers certainly isn't, you know, kept up to date. And I it was just a nice touch, I thought, for a 32-cent stamp, you know.
Yeah, good point. Do you participate in union-sponsored activities?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, obviously, because the position I hold as an international rep, I'm told... It's kind of funny as politics roll around, because I'm headquartered in Detroit. They tell me who I'll work on. They tell me I'll go door to door in Warren or Grosse Pointe or wherever, and then I'll get calls. It's interesting. I'll get calls from local activists here, and you know I politely tell them, you know, they want me to do a door to door in Clinton County or something else, and I said, well, you know, that'd be nice, but if I'm not in Warren doing a door-to-door this weekend, I'm in trouble, you know. So it's funny how my politics, when I say national, I'm referring to national politics, how that's all shifted down to Detroit area, away from this area. But yeah, it's something we do, and it's something I do regardless. I mean, it's once you got it in your blood, you're gonna, you know.
And when you were president, you did start a few social activities or cultural programs. Why don't you share a little bit about that?
Well, the whole idea is, and Marilyn, Marilyn Colder was obviously a big part of it. She was the civil rights chair. I think you were elected the second time when I got elected first time as president. Mm-hmm. And she was the godmother, if you will, of this Black History program that was run in conjunction with Black History Month. And she was a spark plug behind it, made that happen. I was tickled pink. I mean, you know, it was funny. I used to go in the plant and would have some older white gentleman, if you will, say, hey, well, this is bullshit. What are you doing? You know, why are we supporting this with union dues and stuff like this? And I would respond that, hey, listen, what ethnicity are you? What are you German? Let's have a German fest. I said I'm not adverse to doing anything that's going to bring our membership together, because that's what a union's all about. And I think that's what we've lost as a union. I mean, you look back at the old girl. And, you know, there was a bar set up in there. You go back in the history of our union, members used to come over there and socialize at that bar. And we've really lost that as a union movement, even today. Some say it may be the fix for it. You know, not to get offhand, but, I mean, you know, what mega churches are doing, that it is a family. This is where you come to enjoy, whether it's bowling, whether it's cards, whether it's whatever. You got to center around a social activity. Having set aside the fact that as a society we've seen to, you know, get glued to the TV and our remote control and everything's okay in my house, the hell with the rest of it. And we've lost that as a society. But I think that's the true meaning of a union. And off of the Black History Program, that is, I'm proud to say, is still successful and rolling today. You know, we did for National Hispanic Month, we did that. We sprung boarded from that. We did a Women's Day program and a lot of good things. And you know, it's interesting because none of that, and I follow our local union enough now that I see now that the members that are a part of that believe so strongly in it that they're even doing fundraisers to support those activities. Where back when I was there, it wasn't a big cost. I mean, you might throw $500, maybe $1,500 seed money into this, and it just took off. And they were great. Everyone I spoke at, the Black History one was the greatest program. And then lo and behold, along comes the Hispanics in the plant that put on a first-rate program. And it was all volunteers, you know, and that's where I put it back in the membership's face, those that wanted to piss and moan about it is, hey, come along. You got a day that you want to celebrate. You know, at one time there was some on the e-board that I believe weren't thinking the right way, that, you know, they wanted a International Solidarity Day. Can't we just do away with all of these? And, you know, I mean, that did away with the pride that was associated with that event. And, you know, they missed the point. You know, I mean, it wasn't, you know, if you want to have an International Solidarity Day, I'm all about that too. When do you want to schedule it? But we're going to still have the other ones, as long as the motion comes aboard and the board supports it. And that's what happened, you know. And one of the other programs that, you know, I was proud of is we expanded the Bible. I mean, when I first got over there were literally brothers and sisters, or brothers and brothers, fighting over who was going to get the Bible of their parent that passed away. And I just thought that was just totally ridiculous, you know. This is nuts. We need to do away with that. And we changed bylaws to do it. The ring program, the 25-year ring program, was something that I was happy to establish and start, and it's still going today. It was a great program. I enjoyed it. I personally delivered each ring to the member that got it. And out of all those rings I delivered, I only remember one person. And it was funny because it goes back to when I was on shop committeeman. This person got discharged. Long story, but anyways, I got him back to work, and he didn't think it was quick enough, you know. And believe me, I got the guy back from a discharge in 3 weeks, and that was a record. He certainly had nothing to complain about. He got fired for stealing, and it was the evidence was pretty cold and pretty hard. I mean, it was there. He was guilty, but he was a good worker. Made a mistake, and was able to convince management to bring him back. Well, that member, for some reason, I handed him his ring and stuck out my hand to shake his hand, and he refused to shake my hand. And it was, I said, whoa, I said, that kind of surprised me. And he said, nah, he said, not time you made me set out being discharged for doing nothing wrong. I said, okay, and walked away. But, you know, the membership loved that program. I enjoyed getting out there, seeing the membership. That's what it's all about.
Marilyn Coulter.
Gary, you worked in the plant, you came in young, you made leaps and bounds, you did wonderful things. And I will take the time to say thank you for being a president to support those programs.
You're welcome.
Because they found out what the UAW did for the civil rights movement. My little commercial. But you did all these things as a president. You said the workers were great. Now, as we sit right here, right across the street, they are literally tearing down our facility. It's closed. What do you think about that? How does it affect you?
When I come around the corner for the interview today, I look there and watch the machines gobbling away at the old girl there, and I'm thinking, damn. It's bittersweet. I knew when I left for the international staff, I felt. While I could have accomplished a few more things, there were some things that I still had ideas I wanted to do. One being making our local union an amalgamated union, because I felt that was the only chance for growth the way the industry was going. And I still believe that today, but that's another story. It's sad because, you know, I always refer to Fisher Body and you see a part of your life just getting gobbled up and put through a crusher and steel hauled out and hauled away. That's sad, but on the other hand, as I referred to before we started taping, it's like the phoenix, you know, out of the ashes rises a new facility. And I certainly know that new facility will be good for our longevity. So that's an obvious plus. I knew that when I left. Marilyn, you were on the e-board. Doug, you were. There was no doubt in anybody's mind when I left that I knew that new facility was going to get built. I mean, Mark Hogan told me, Gary, you landed a good one. At one time, they were talking about us getting the Cadillac facility, and I remember at the time me talking to Mark Hogan and Jim Zupkus at the time, and me saying I don't want to build Cadillacs. And Zupkus kind of looked, Gary, you know, we think we can make some things, we can rearrange, get the body plant, everything on over there, they can continue building, we'll keep this whole thing going and build Cadillacs here. And I said, nah, Zub, I said, you know, it's not a high volume car. And I felt strongly about that, knowing the industry the way I did, that, you know, I appreciate that, and I know I'd have one in the barn, but man, what about that other project? Of course, back then, it wasn't the Lambda, it wasn't anything, you know, it was just, they knew there was going to be a new project brought online. And I said, you know, I'd really, really like to have that. And at that time, they didn't even have the land bought. They didn't know, I mean, there's speculation, of course, everything's tight-lidded, because they don't want nobody out there capitalizing on the real estate. But they knew they were going to try to acquire a large group of property. I sat on a committee with the mayor of Lansing. I knew it was going to happen. There was no doubt. The day I left, I felt good that I at least left something here. Or I felt I was a part of making the future stable here in Lansing. And, you know, felt good about that. So while it's bittersweet. I mean, you know, you hate to see the old girl go. While I say it's nice to have that new facility, that isn't. It will not be a part of a community like Fisher Body was. I mean, you know, you probably could tell by my earlier comments, I like to toss a few back and have a few pops every once in a while. And the uniqueness of being in a community like we are at Fisher Body is not going to be replicated out there in the field in Delta Township. I mean, you know, I don't want to emphasize on the fact that we had a bar on the northeast, south, and west corners, but that's what gets established around an enterprise like Fisher Body, and in turn, other people prosper out of the community, and I think that was unique. I mean, it's unique to the school, you know. I mean, going outside and just simply getting some fresh air and watching the kids over at the playground across the street. That's not going to be a part of the new facility. There's just little things that make the workplace a part of the community that goes beyond digging into our pocket and sharing our wealth with the community. It you can't replicate that. And so that's the saddest part. But, you know, and then seeing the old girl, I mean, our union hall has got a proud, proud history. I mean, you know, when the governor of the state comes at a ribbon cutting, I think that says a lot about the labor movement at that time. And that of course was G. Menon Williams. Soapy Williams was there helping cut the ribbon at our union hall, and you know, you don't see that anymore, unfortunately. So sad, but I guess there is some sweetness or some light at the end of the tunnel. Certainly great to have a new facility.
Gary, one other question for me. What would you say are some things that people may not know about factory workers that might be something that they thought was true but was totally untrue? What are some of the things about factory workers that people that you found to be shocking, a little bit different?
Well, I would classify it more, Marilyn, as you know, we all know what the stereotypes are, and we all know how false they are. you know, my years as a union rep, you know, whether it was the first line supervisor or someone who didn't work in a factory, say, you know, Gary, you spend 95% of your time representing 5% of the people. And I would even have, you know, I was been called the enabler. I've been called a lot of, I take them as badge of honors, but some people trying to whack me, like, what are you doing for that deadbeat, that drunk, that druggie, whatever the case may be. And I said, well, I'm representing to the best of my ability. And would actually have members say, you know, Gary, give it up. You know, he's a loser. You know, and I'd say, you know, and my quick response was that, you know what, I says, you know, I know you don't put in a lot of calls, but I says, you just need to be happy and rest assured that if I can do that for what you term as a loser, and I don't look at him that way, I look at him as somebody that needs some help, just think what I can do for you. And it'd bring a smile to their face, and they'd nod, still not happy that I got what they thought of as a loser out of a discipline or a discharge or whatever the case may be. And then, like I say, as that circled around, you know, I remember those very people would be told, okay, everybody, clean out your lockers. You know, we're going to rearrange the area at shutdown or a changeover, they used to call them. And that same person that might have thought I took care of the losers, well, lo and behold, he thought, yeah, geez, these bolts or these emblems have been in my locker for all this time. And, you know, I put them in the lunchbox. And on they go home. Nothing that amounted to a hill of beans to General Motors. But unfortunately, the security guard said, hey, open your lunchbox. And oops, you know, now this 28-year man, I remember there was a host of them in the trim shop when I was shop committeeman. There was about four or five of them that got long seniority people that got popped on that changeover time when they said, clean out your locker. And they got, I mean, it was diddle in their thing. It was nothing major. And got discharged that I was able to, you know, get the wheels in motion and get them back to work in short order. And, you know, it just makes you feel good. A long-winded dog barrel, but I think most of those are stereotypes. We're just like everybody else. I've said it. We're not here. You know, I said it earlier in the thing. We're not here out of a lifelong ambition to build Pontiac Grand Ams. We're here because we enjoy the communities we live in, and this job affords us the opportunity to do what we really, really, really enjoy, and that's coaching the kids, that's partaking in our community, at our church's activities, you know, whatever it might be. That's what it's really all about. And those auto line workers are just like anybody else. There's the old labor relations formula. You know, you hear it now, we're getting paid too much. You know, the old formula says you pay what it takes to hire and retain a skilled workforce. That's how we got where we're at today. That's what we are today, is a skilled workforce. That skill may very well be the ability to sit there and do that same thing, you know, car after car, hour after hour, minute after minute. That is a skill that I'll never discredit anybody for having, because there's a whole lot of people that have come and gone that didn't have that skill and that ability to do that.
I know also when you talk about skill, and you talk about one of your good friends, Mike Roach,
mm-hmm.
who was somebody who that went to college, had a large degree, and he did later leave.
Yep.
But did you also find through your travels that there were a lot of people who worked on that line who had degrees, but they had to come there to get a good lifestyle?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Jack, the attorney, you know, there were people that had law practices that came into that factory every night and, you know, continued working for General Motors. And that was for the benefits and you know, we did get paid well. We got paid what we were worth. I would maintain we all used to joke when time and a half kicked in that finally we're getting paid what we're worth. But no, there were a lot of good, and they took those skills. They tell me that nowadays they're tapping into that skill set and trying to have them more participative in the workplace, or give them opportunities to contribute in the workplace. I got mixed feelings on all that, but they would take them skills and them talents, and you would find them, pour them into their communities into their churches and everything else. Like I say, they did. We do what we do over there so we can enjoy what we really enjoy doing, and that's spending time with our family, in our communities, and in our churches and stuff. So, yeah.
Gary, I am Doug Rademacher. I was just recently at the recognition of the sit-down strikers, and there's about a dozen left. The 1937 sit-down strike that gained the right to be the sole bargainer for the United the auto workers across America. As we are at a time today, and you being on the international staff, where the labor movement's at an all-time low, got anything to say about what do you see for the future?
It's, you know, I've never seen. I could talk for hours on this, but I've never seen such an orchestrated effort by the anti-union, or anti—I would go so far as anti-American. You know, that we move to this Walmartization of America, I call it. That it's, you know, capitalism has almost become consumerism. That you know, it isn't really about jobs. It isn't really about your communities. It isn't really about anything. What it is about is getting the consumer the cheapest product you possibly can, and that being driven by the anti-right to work, the anti-union forces. If you go back in our history, there's no doubt in my mind why those forces are trying to destroy the labor movement. There's no doubt in my mind, because in our heyday, we controlled it. We was controlling. We was electing. We was getting respect out of not only state house, not out of our house and senate and governor here in Michigan, but in Washington D.C., the entire Congress. The influence that we had of getting those people in place come back tenfold back to our members. A lot of our members didn't understand it. A lot of our members, I don't know, were probably voting for the ones that were taking the jobs out of this country. But you can't help but think that and hope. That someday we will, like old Fisher Body, we will rise again. You know, that people will finally wake up and smell the coffee and say, "Hey, you know, now I do see the dots are connected." You know, it probably gets a lot of play, and how true it is. You know, Walter Reuther saying, you know, there is a direct relationship between the ballot box and the bread box. If I haven't said that 1,000 times while I was president, I still repeat it, and people understand that, I hope. But unfortunately, the antis, the Republican Party, destroying this country, it just blows me away. I mean, how we can be talking and seeing, you know, the loss of jobs that have happened. How they can even entertain now, well, let's go to Taiwan and let them in. What little trade tariffs we got that still support our workers, they want to do away with them. And you know, if this Walmartization continues of America, that's what I call it, I don't know what the answer is. You know, it befuddles me. As a union, you know, we don't connect, unfortunately, the way we used to. And maybe it was, you know, the sit-down strikers seeing the worst of times. And you know, I like to think that the educational system would make people understand that they're the worst of times. But unfortunately, you crack open a history book in schools today, if you've got one paragraph about the UAW and Walter Reuther, who, you know, I would tell groups, I still tell groups, if you looked at it, you know, the 70s, that, my God, just think where this country would be if Jackie Kennedy, and I would say Bobby Kennedy more so than John, Martin Luther King, Walter Reuther were still alive today. The course that this country would have took and where we would be today, I think no one's appealed to the masses like those folks did. The sad part of it is that was in the 60s. You know, and we were making gains, social gains back then that have just, I don't know, name a social gain since those folks were alive. They're zilch. They're zilch. Other than what you see coming from the labor movement, and that's in collective bargaining. We don't have the success in Washington, D.C. like we have anymore, we used to have. And so, you know, one could say, well, what we need is, and I hear this all the time, we ought to just shut this country down. I don't know what we'd accomplish. I mean, to be honest with you, maybe people say, oh, well, geez, but we found that our own members come through the back door and hurt us. I mean, look at the struggles we've had. The Caterpillar is the one that comes to mind the most. There was a 6-year struggle there that they basically bent us over a stump, to put it bluntly. And the workers come back crawling at a much reduced wage, much reduced benefits, everything. We just renegotiated that contract. Those folks were on par and ahead. Fact of it is, we always would use the ag industry to promote the auto industry. I mean, it was a give and take. Hell, sometimes the ag had a better contract than the auto industry did. But we always used to swap back and forth ideas and grow together. Today, they're far behind us. They're far behind us. At one time, they were par with us. So, I don't know, Doug, what the answer is. I'm waiting for that. I'm waiting for the next Bobby Kennedy or Walter Reuther or Martin Luther King to move forward. I mean, it's sad. It's a sad testament to the way I believe the national politics of what in this country. But I guess it's evolutionary. I don't know. You hope the old saying, history repeats itself. I hope I see it repeat itself in my lifetime, because I was a benefactor of the good times. And I'm only this September, I'll have my 30 years in. I tell you what, in 1976, when I talked about the PPH's day, the vision, I believed in my mind that, by God, we're going to have a day off a month. When we lost them, we had 9. The auto industry went on tough times in 82. The leadership made the tough decisions, and that went out the door. But I believe, that I hope I'm alive to see history repeat itself, because it'll be a great, great day.
Well, it's been a pleasure interviewing you. We thank you for taking the time out of your time.
Thank you for appreciate the input.
Taking a moment to share with the students out there in the future what it was all about.
Yep.
And again, thank you, Gary.
I applaud you guys for doing this.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks a whole lot.